Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of Connecting with CAN, a podcast dedicated to sharing Kuwaiti Network's experiences on working with migrant workers. I'm your host, Sahej Racy. On today's podcast, we have Jeffrey Martin, and we'll be talking about the origins of CAN, the social and cultural barriers faced when helping migrant workers. Hi, Jeff. How are you today?
I'm great, Sahej. Thanks for having me again.
Of course, of course. So let's get started. So in Kuwait, there seems to be a lot of social and cultural barriers that migrant workers face. And one example that I can think of are issues with nationalities and class. So could you just talk a little bit about that?
Definitely. It's a really, really important issue. And I think one of the major barriers to, you know, helping people who are vulnerable in Kuwait is kind of understanding this class and identity dynamic. I mean, The main thing to understand about nationality and class here is often they're actually the same. So often nationalities, like let's say, for example, Filipino nationals are typically in specific types of jobs, or Egyptian nationals are in specific types of jobs. So often the class and nationality actually intersect. So I mean, for example, the lowest paying jobs or the most difficult jobs are typically done by Bangladeshi workers, if you're talking about street cleaners or basic laborers or Yemeni laborers from the Republic of Yemen. Typically, these are considered the lower paying jobs, but they're also defined by class. Typically, like pay or salaries are also defined by class. So depending on your nationality, you are paid by based on your not by your job or your skills, but actually by your nationality. So for example, if you're a Filipino national who works at a school as a teacher's assistant, you may be paid upwards of 350 to 400 dinars a month. But if you're a Egyptian national, you may be paid between 250 and 350. And this just depends on the employer. But typically, the nationality actually defines how much you're paid. Often, this isn't just based on a scale of which nationalities are the most important on like a racial hierarchy. The other reason is, of course, because of exchange rate of currencies. So often, employers calculate the salaries of different nationalities based on off of what the Kuwaiti dinar translates into their home currency. So for example, for an Egyptian national, you know, converting the Kuwaiti dinar to the Egyptian pound, a 250 KD a month salary is a very good salary in Egypt, an excellent salary. So because the exchange rate is just so good. So often employers will create salaries for specific nationalities based on the conversion rate. That's one reason. The other reason that's more important is actually the racial dynamic. So there's a hierarchy. This is, of course, not just in the Gulf, but we'll talk about the Gulf now. There's a hierarchy in nationality. So the main nationality would be Kuwaiti nationals. And then within the Kuwaiti nationals, there's varying levels of hierarchy based off of, you know, bloodline and lineage, tribe, when the family, tribe, or group settled in the country, the earlier the better. Whether the group is Sunni or Shia is also a marker. And then outside of Kuwaiti nationals, the next rank would be Westerners or Europeans or Western countries, industrialized countries like Japan or China or Russia or South Korea or Taiwan would be an example. And then below them would be the lower class workers or middle class workers, which would range from, you know, Arab nationals who are considered slightly higher ranked, like Lebanese or Egyptian, and then proceeding from them to Filipino nationals, and then from Filipino nationals to a variety of other nationals, with Bangladeshi nationals at the bottom, typically speaking, and sometimes Yemeni nationals at the bottom as well. So the issue of nationalities is based off of conversion rate and racism. And this defines the economy in Kuwait. Sometimes the way I look at it is, if you know the show Handmaid's Tale, where people wear different uniforms or different dresses depending on their station, in many ways in Kuwait, because of the kafala system and this racial hierarchy, you'll get people basically, you meet someone who's Indian, that defines their job, generally speaking. Or if you meet someone who's Filipino, it defines their job and their salary based off their nationality, not off their skill set. And this is a larger systematic issue in general. And this is defined by the kafala system. The sponsorship system heavily encourages hiring based on racial hierarchy, because the kafala system isn't based off of merit. It's based off of sponsorship. So, for example, I'll give one example. Filipino nationals, Filipino women are generally considered the highest in-demand domestic servant. The reason for this is several factors. One is they tend to be considered compliant. This is a stereotype. They tend to be considered very hard workers who have no problem working 16-hour days. They tend to be considered better because they speak good English, and they have, generally speaking, have some training to be a domestic worker before they arrive in country. And so for this reason, they're considered to be in demand for domestic worker jobs. That would be one example of a pretty niche category for a specific national.
Why is this the case? Is it part of a larger systemic issue that goes beyond the economic realm of money exchange or what jobs they can have?
100%, absolutely. I mean, this systemic issue goes beyond just the economic variables and goes directly into, you know, social life, because it defines, you know, where you can be entertained or where you go out. It defines, you know, what you can do, because, I mean, because of the job, it defines because of the salary level, it defines the quality of life of that person. So often you'll find, you know, like in many countries, ghettos filled with specific types of people based off of their nationality, not based off their job, because that nationality tends to be in specific jobs. So it creates very insulated communities, because within certain sectors, it will only be that national. For example, like I said, Filipino maids would be a category of a lot of nationals, or like a lot of Filipinos are in maid jobs. So it tends to be, you know, dominated by them. Or if you're looking at construction, typically it's Egyptian or Yemeni. And this actually drives, you know, very insulated communities. It actually creates barriers between, like, as you know, as the, you know, the podcast is about, it creates barriers between different nationalities actually knowing each other. It creates a lot of insulated communities. It creates a lot of stigmas towards knowing about different communities within different categories of work. And it leads to a lot of miscommunications and misunderstanding of, you know, what communities are in Kuwait, what communities are doing, what resources they have, what issues they have. And also just generally helps to build stereotypes about specific types of nationalities, because, you know, for example, if Bangladeshi workers are only generally considered street cleaners, or low-level laborers, which is not true, but it's a stereotype, this actually lends the credibility that Bangladeshi nationals can only do those low-labor jobs, and they're not educated, which is not true, but it leads to a stigma towards specific nationalities. So, for example, if you meet someone who's Bangladeshi, who has a job that's, you know, not a low-level labor job or not a cleaner, people assume that because they're Bangladeshi, they have a low-level job and they are poor. And these types of stereotypes are highly damaging within and between communities, because it lowers the expectations or merit positions of people.
And now this leads me to my next question, where I think there's a lot of stigma towards those who help migrant workers. So how is this expressed by Kuwaiti nationals and high-income migrants? And actually, I'm curious, do other nationalities, meaning Bangladeshis or Filipinos, do they have some sort of stigma or stereotype towards each other because of, like, this class divide?
I think that's those are really good questions. I mean, I'll answer this in two parts. I mean, there's a lot of stigma towards migrant workers helping each other and others helping migrant workers. I mean, everybody who's in Kuwait who's not Kuwaiti is a migrant worker, unless you're stateless, which is a different status. So as migrant workers, I mean, there is a lot of stigma towards helping migrant workers for a lot of different reasons. But I think the main stigma is, if it was to be expressed by Kuwaiti nationals from my own experience, is that why would you help people in this country if they don't have a good time here, or if their life isn't good, they should leave and go back to their own country. That's one of the primary stereotypes or, rationales for not helping, is that why don't they just leave? This is the common thing that's said. Well, if you don't like it here, leave. And if it's bad for you, you should just go home. And this is based off the assumption of someone in a privileged status that they have something to go home to, or a safety net, or it's that easy, which, of course, for vulnerable migrant workers, they do not have money for a plane ticket. They do not have money for food next week. They do not have money for rent next week. So the assumption that they can just leave, or if they're deported, they can just go home and start again. It's not that simple and straightforward. But because of the barriers between people even knowing what's going on within different communities, there's a lot of assumptions that they're just, you know, they're not actually poor. They're actually like hoarding their money, and they're secretly able to do whatever they want. But, you know, they're secretly, able to do the same thing as privileged people. And this is, of course, not a Gulf or Kuwait specific issue. Privileged people all over the world tend to believe that poor people are poor because they either are pretending to be poor or they're using or they could be better if they just, you know, pulled up their belts. That's kind of one of the issues. Within communities, of course, I mean, you use the example of Bangladeshi nationals or Filipino nationals. But I mean, between communities, of course, there is different racial tendencies. There's different xenophobic attitudes depending on the nationality. Most nationalities have issues with other nationalities. The barriers that are set up because of the kafala system, the occupations being dominated by specific nationals, the type of salaries that are given depending on different types of nationals, this generates a lot of competition and a lot of distrust between nationalities, especially if they're competing for the same jobs. So like I said before, Filipino nationals tend to be highly prized as domestic maids, but other nationalities also hold those positions. So for example, Sri Lankan or Nepali or Indian nationals also prize those positions. They're generally considered good paying jobs. But because Filipino domestic workers are considered to be higher priced and thus worth a higher salary, that actually creates competition and actually lowers the salary of other nationals. You're not Filipino, therefore I'm going to pay you 50 KD less a month. And these types of rationales are used to lower the salaries of other domestic workers from different nationalities. So this actually drives divisions and competition between them and leads to, you know, obviously speaking, I mean, someone who's a domestic worker that's Filipino or someone who's a domestic worker that not is a, you know, is Indian, for example, that has nothing to do, of course, with their merit and skill as a domestic worker. But because of the assumption and stereotypes, you know, for example, that Filipinos are quote unquote cleaner, for example, and this is like a racial hygienic thing that's, you know, xenophobic. These types of actually attitudes actually propel competition between different nationalities. And this is actually at the core of the kafala sponsorship system is it creates divisions. It develops racial barriers. It mitigates any sense of cooperation between communities. And that's, you know, first and foremost because of economic reasons and then the racial reasons that come with the economic reasons.
That's great. I was just thinking of something you said right at the start of answering those questions. And I find it quite funny or humbling, I guess, if that's the word to use, that many Kuwaiti nationals just think that migrant workers should go back to their countries when not only do they make up, I believe, 70% of the population in Kuwait, but are also like the main drive for the economy. And without them, that Kuwait would not essentially collapse, but would be on the brink of collapse.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, I mean, one of the issues that I think is the central issue that, from an obvious economic standpoint, 70% of the country is non-Kuwaiti, and the vast majority of those jobs are service industry jobs of all kinds. Healthcare is over 95% non-Kuwaiti. Most municipal services until relatively recently were overwhelmingly non-Kuwaiti because it's a small country and there's not enough people with those specific skill sets to do the jobs or want to do the jobs. I think one of the major issues that is a barrier between Kuwaiti nationals understanding the need for migrant workers of all types and all occupations is that not over 90% of Kuwaitis work in the public sector in government jobs. And in these government jobs, there are very few foreigners working in the ministries. And if there is foreigners working in the ministries, they're either high-level consultants working at a very high level, or they're low-level service personnel, whether they're low-level techs or secretaries or T-boys or janitorial staff. So the typical Kuwaiti citizen who's working's experience, there are very few foreign workers working with them. And the ones that are in very specific positions. So for them, their perspective is they don't really understand, I would say this is my own opinion, they don't really understand the importance of these people, the economy. The other thing I think that's probably a more important issue is that tends to be this belief that Kuwait is a very valuable place to live. And if you get rid of people, regardless of the reason they get rid of them, that there'll always be someone to replace them. And this is one of the main issues the country's had in developing a productive labor market is there's this kind of intrinsic belief that because Kuwait has a very nice conversion rate, that anybody would come here. And as soon as someone leaves, no matter how badly they're treated or how it might damage the reputation of the country, that there's always someone to replace them because Kuwait's just a valuable place to live. Now, that is true that Kuwait is a very productive place to live. if you have a good job and you're settled properly. But what has happened over the last two decades is Kuwait has developed quite a reputation for a place that doesn't protect labor rights, or employers don't protect labor rights, that it isn't a pleasant place to live, that the sponsorship system makes it very difficult to live a productive, peaceful life here. And I think something that's been happening actually mostly because of COVID pandemic is a kind of an eye-opening event where people don't want to live here anymore because of the bad reputation, and also because it's very difficult to live a life here under the sponsorship system. But for most Kuwaiti nationals, they don't really get to see this because of their job and occupation. They're not actually, they're insulated, just like migrant workers are from each other. They're also insulated from migrant workers. And this, again, is the nature of the Kuwaiti system. It divides communities from each other. They don't get to see each other, other than by very strict hierarchies of race and class and economic standing.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is some merit to the statement that, like, there's always going to be someone to replace them, where people from lower economic countries are coming. But I do remember, I remember reading that I believe the Philippines and several African countries put sanctions on Kuwait because of, like, the mistreatment of migrant workers, especially for female domestic workers. And they had to get a contract signed or something along those lines to be able to send over migrant workers. So there definitely are several countries that are, I guess, realizing the reputation of Kuwait and sort of putting on sanctions for their own migrant workers for their safety.
Yeah, I mean, there is. I mean, a lot of, like you spoke about the Philippines as one example. I mean, there's been issues for many years, but this started largely because of a murder of a domestic worker, a very brutal murder of a domestic worker by, it wasn't actually by Kuwaiti nationals, it was by Syrian nationals, like expats, like other expatriate migrant workers living in Kuwait. And this led to a renegotiation of the rules around how much salary they were paid, what kind of legal rights they had. And I mean, Filipino nationals have better rights as nationals in Kuwait than many of the other nationalities that are in these types of jobs positions because of negotiations between the Filipino government and the Kuwaiti government at the highest level. And I mean, the issue now is, and I mean, this is an issue not just in Kuwait, but in the Gulf and the world at wide, is that there's a worldwide labor shortage, and not just labor at not menial labor or just like low level service level, but labor loss, like shortages of highly technically skilled staff of all kinds in all backgrounds. And because of this increase in demand and also, the reduction in the labor pool, and much of this is driven by, the recession in the world economy and also a drive for people to move to Western countries. This has led to a shortage of labor here at the very time when the country is attempting to expand its economy out of an oil dominated economy into a private sector one, where they need significant amounts of skilled labor of all types, from plumbers to electricians to, welders, different types of technical service staff jobs. These types of things are highly prized now at the very time that, the reputation has actually not become very good, or it's become, people have become more aware of something. I mean, the issues Kuwait has had have been around for decades, but it's more now that, social media, news, a labor shortage have all contributed to like a really damaging effect. And I mean, it's not to say that the Kuwaiti government isn't working on things. They are. There is attempts to redefine the labor law, but it's very difficult because of the nature of the rules around sponsorship, which are ingrained in the labor system. To simply change these things overnight would be very, very difficult. And the real issue is, of course, that in a perfect world, they would have time to reform the system to slowly wean themselves off of it, like many countries in the region are doing. Qatar is doing this. Saudi is doing this. Emirates has already done a lot of this. Oman is also doing this. But the issue in Kuwait is that it might be too late, that it's going too slow. And one of the hallmarks of Kuwaiti politics is that everything moves very slowly. Everything's very, very carefully calculated so that all major political groups are in agreement about the decision made. But in the current economic situation, with oil becoming less important than it was in the past, the writing's on the wall for oil as the only source of energy worldwide, Kuwait has to move pretty quickly to reform these things. And one of the ways it needs to reform is its labor market. Now, can Kuwait reform it quickly enough? That's an open question. And there's a lot of challenges to that.
Yeah, I mean, the cultural barriers that go entail with the stigma that you know, a lot of Kuwaiti nationals and high income migrants have, and how there's a labor shortage. I can't even believe, I mean, I guess I can, how it impacts people's willingness to help people in terms of, like, you know, they see this issue of a labor shortage and they see this issue of so much stigma and how it's being portrayed worldwide now. And yet there's still so much unwillingness to help migrant workers.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of it is, I mean, a lot of these issues are related to lack of awareness. And I mean, this is one of the reasons we're doing these podcasts, and, you know, is just to actually help raise awareness of some of these issues. A lot because of the very thick barriers or like rigid barriers between different communities, a lot of the information that should be shared between them are lost. Between privileged classes of people and these vulnerable migrant communities, there's not a lot of communication other than day-to-day work. People don't know what's going on within other communities. People do not know what's going on in other areas of the city. It's very divided. And really, I mean, this is not a government responsibility. This is actually a civil society responsibility. Nonprofits, you know, human rights organizations, labor unions. This is the responsibility of those organizations, not a government, to actually provide people with the information and to talk about these things and debate them, debate the difficult topics, raise awareness of some of the issues that are going on, talk about what can be done. And I mean, simply put, like, I mean, the main solution to all this is just to keep talking about it and to raise awareness of these social and cultural barriers so we can move past them. And that's not an easy feat. That takes time, a lot of time.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, that's all I have for today. So
perfect.
I'd like to thank you all for listening to this episode of Connecting with Can. We hope you're having a wonderful day and we'll see you next week. Stay connected.